Each of us reacted to the violence of the last week out of his own perspective. White America was again frightened and awed by black violence, and puzzling as it had done for many years, how the problem of urban terrorism might be handled. Black America was again chagrined by black on black violence. And I suspect, conscious again that of the fact that a black life is not as worth as much as a white life. For how could they but ask the question, if it had been a white television commentator who had been killed and a white member of the federal establishment who had been seriously wounded, would, in fact, the man who had organized this terror be free on the streets of Washington? And Jews, I'm sure, concentrated on the events at the B'nai B'rith National Headquarters. For here we were seeing in 1977 an old story being recreated. Other men were quarreling about issues of which we had no immediate role, and we were the victims. We were the hostages. Here was anti-Semitism in all of its medieval splendor. The B'nai B'rith headquarters was not an afterthought, but the command headquarters of these terrorists. And the Jews who were there because they were Jews. Those who hid their Jewishness or who were obviously not Jews were either freed or treated differently. And all the curses and all of the ugly verbal violence with which Jews are all too familiar was expressed during those 2 days of the siege. I confess that I was troubled by the unwillingness, the seeming unwillingness of the media to deal with this recrudescence, this revival of anti-Semitism. They made it seem as if the only issues in the minds of these black Muslims of the Hanafiya sect was the fact that they disagreed with the portrayal of Muhammad in some moving picture and that they had a blood vengeance need against a number of people who had killed members of their families. But in point of fact, it's obvious that Jews were the enemy. Why? Because we were Jews. What was our crime? We were Jews. And somehow the media was unwilling to deal with this fact. They listed all the other causes. And when the events had run their course, they treated the 2 days in Washington as if they were somehow a triumph of the religious spirit. Had not the Muslim ambassadors quoted Islamic poetry in the Quran to the members of the Hanafiya sect? Had not Muslim ambassadors and a Roman Catholic chief of police been able to negotiate the release of Jewish hostages? Somehow the idea of Muslim leaders and Roman Catholic chiefs of police negotiating the release of Jewish hostages does not warm my soul. The Jewish hostages should not have been taken in the first place. But more, I am troubled by the innocence, if it be that, of the American people who somehow are comforted by Bible reading, as if the recitation of scripture, whoever scripture it is a guarantee of some kind of decency. Need we be reminded that the Crusaders read their Bible and that the Jihad, holy war in Islam, is proclaimed by the Quran? Need we be reminded that one of the major roots of anti-Semitism in the West exists because of the stereotypes about the hypocritical Jew, the deicidical Jew in the New Testament? Our people are not at all unfamiliar of incidents throughout Europe when pastors read from the New Testament and their parishioners spilled out into the streets and made for the ghetto to kill Jews. And what is true of the New Testament is true of the Quran. Muhammad may have been interested in the conversion of the Jews, but when he found that this was impossible, he turned in righteous anger and ordered the extermination of a number of the Jewish towns in the Hejaz. And the Quran is filled with violent ugliness against Jews. One of the things this country least likes to do is to admit that in the soul of many of its citizens, there are all kinds of vicious and violent medieval prejudices. That the past is not behind us. But unless we begin to understand who we are and where some of us are, what possibility really is there to organize community? Now, I watched these events from a particular perspective, perhaps a unique one. Because of the requirements of our bulletin, I have to decide on the topic for these sermons 3 or 4 weeks in advance. And about a month ago, I decided to speak this morning on the theme, Can They Forget? What does it mean to be a survivor? I was moved to do so by some thoughts that had come to me as I read a recently published analysis of interviews with 100 or so men and women who had survived the Nazi death camps, who had come to America in the late 1940s, and who now, a quarter of a century or more later, had built for themselves here new lives, which incidentally is the title of this volume. Can they forget? What does it mean to be a survivor? And I wondered as I watched these events on television and read about them in the newspapers, what it meant to be a survivor of the Naboth headquarters. Two events are obviously different in quantity and in quality. There was no actual bloodletting. One lasted for years, one for less than 2 days. But there was the same explosive quality of anti-Semitism to both of them. There was the same presence of death, fear of death, the reality of death. There were the same troubling questions of one's identity, what one discovers in moments of crisis. I kept wondering what this Jewish woman will feel who took the little necklace with the Star of David from her neck to hide the fact that she was Jewish when next she comes into a synagogue. I kept wondering if the non-Jews who experience this violence will have some kind of understanding now of the sense of being exposed which Jews carry around with them. I wondered if the young college student who denied that he was Jewish because he was in fact only half Jewish, he had a Jewish parent, realized how much he had been taken in by the Nazi theories of religion and race, that one can be half something by somehow genetically. I wondered if those who were Jewish and who accepted, what else could they do, who accepted and endured these 2 days of terror, if they will feel now more burdened by the fact of their belonging to an exposed people or closer to the people. I wondered what it means to be a survivor. If the experience which is documented among the survivors of the Nazi death camps has any relationship to these more recent events, this much seems clear, that life will go on, that externally it will seem as if nothing has happened, but that each of these people has somehow deep within his soul confronted himself and found their courage or cowardice, has had to recognize the madness of life, and can no longer be as secure, as innocently secure, as comfortable as they might have been before. And I suspect, too, that there'll be a new bond of friendship between those who went through this ordeal. Just as the survivors of the Holocaust have their congregations and their meetings and their societies, because they understand without words, so I suspect these people will have from time to time reunions, because they will tell those who have not experienced it what those are prepared to hear. But to themselves they will know that terror does not ennoble, but that the human spirit is remarkably resilient. That they have faced danger and they have found out in the process something about themselves. Now, this was not obviously the preamble to the sermon I'd originally intended to give this morning. But in a sense, it's unavoidable given the events of the past. They are not directly identical, equivalent, but there are certain equivalences. But when one looks at the violence and the cruelty and the terror and the sadism and the torture and the dislocation which those who survived the death camps went through, and when one reads of their lives, of what they've made of themselves and the new lives that they've managed to establish for themselves, I must say that one is given a sense of encouragement. Because there's an amazing resiliency to the human spirit. It's well to remember, because we say the words so glibly, it's well to remember that those who survived the death camps and the concentration camps and the labor camps and the long hiding, and sometimes simply those who survived the long years of being in the fields and the hills as guerrilla warriors, that these people were not only threatened every day of their lives, not only undernourished, starved, tortured, beaten, but that they lived in a world where unreason was the governing force, a world of madness, a world which attacked every one of the values by which they had been raised. And that when they were liberated from that world, they were not only living corpses, starved remnants of the Jews of Europe, but they were people who now found themselves homeless, not yet free. When we release a prisoner from jail, he has no freedom if he has no place to go, if all he can do is roam the streets. He's really still a punished man. But if he has a home to go to and to begin life again, he is free, free to start over, free to begin again. There were some 50,000 youngish men and women who somehow survived the death camps and the concentration camps, and 100,000 more who were in labor battalions or in hiding in Central and Eastern Europe. And when the war was over, these people were liberated, given candy bars, and photographed, and then taken to another set of camps. There was no place for them to go. The Allies, at the end of the war, had a program for the repatriation of people to their homes. The Hungarians were to go back to Hungary, the Romanians to Romania, the Poles to Poland, the Germans to Germany, the Czechs to Czechoslovakia. And the Jews at the time were declared simply to be Poles or Hungarians or Romanians or Germans. And the idea was that they too would be repatriated, they would go home. The fact that many Jews could not imagine going home to live among the butchers never entered the Allied mind. And many Jews tried to go home again. And when they went home to Lodz or to Krakow or to Warsaw, they discovered either that their apartment was bombed out, no longer there, or was now occupied by a good Pole or a good Hungarian, who told them, it's mine now. And when they went to visit the magistrate, he gave them some papers to fill out and said to them, in essence, don't call us, we'll call you. And often they recognized the magistrate as one of those who, as a civilian mayor or member of council, had taken his gun and gone out into the field to hunt for Jews, to help the Nazis. There were 9 million displaced persons in the beginning of 1945. 7 million of these were repatriated by the end of 1945. The displaced person camps were transit centers, and they were quickly diminished in terms of population. But the number of Jews in the camps grew month by month. Many never left. Many left and came back. In April of 1945, the Soviet Union repatriated to Poland all Polish citizens who were behind their lines, Jews, non-Jews, Ukrainians, all. And tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of Jews went back to Poland. And they found in Poland, in Warsaw, where the ghetto had been, emptiness. And they found in other towns their apartments occupied, and they found a pogrom in Kielce, and another pogrom in southern Russia, in southern Poland. Jews were again being hunted. No one wanted to give the Jew back his apartment or his job or his position. And these Jews began to filter through to the camps. The number of the Jews in the camps grew month by month, grew by tens of thousands every month. And these people who were the pitiable survivors of the final solution, who had suffered the tortures of the damned, now had to suffer the tortures of indifference as well as of homelessness. The British in their zone, who incidentally had responsibility for refugee relief in all of the areas, quickly closed their zone to the further intransit of Jewish refugees. They refused to look on the refugees in their displaced camps as anything but Poles or Hungarians. They were not Jews. There was nothing special about being a Jew. And a British general by the name of Morgan, who was the commander of the British zone, published a document for London in which he warned against the fact that tens of thousands of Jews were coming from the East, motivated, he said, by the manipulations of international Jewish organizations with political purposes. And more, he said, these Jews are really not refugees. Many of them are quite wealthy. They're carrying around bags full of gold. That from the Allies. An allied, a responsible senior allied official at the end of the war. That's what these refugees, these displaced persons, these living corpses faced. And in the American zone, the camps were crude and quickly overcrowded. And finally, in June of 1945, President Truman ordered the dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a man by the name of Harrison, to make a report on conditions in the camps. And Mr. Harrison went and in 6 weeks observed and returned a report which said, in effect, the Jews have to be labeled as such because their problems are unique. The Jews want, above all else, to go to Palestine. They don't want to go to those places we call their home. The camps' conditions are harsh, the food is unacceptable, the medical conditions are minimal, they must be improved, we must make some kinds of provisions for them. And it is he who first made the recommendation that the United States government request the United Kingdom for 100,000 visas for Jews to enter Palestine. He reported to the president in August of 1945. The president immediately did two things. He ordered General Eisenhower to improve the conditions in the camp, and he made public the request for England to allow 100,000 displaced persons, Jews, into the Holy Land. He also talked with members of Congress about the possibility of a displaced persons law which will allow sizable numbers of these displaced persons, now there were almost 500,000 Jews in the camps, to come into the United States. August passes into September, September into October, October into November, November into December. Congress is adamant. There will be no displaced persons law. We have to demobilize our own army. There's unemployment in the United States. We can't bring these people in. And finally, in December of 1945, President Truman issued an executive order, which said, in effect, that a number of visas should be issued ahead of time to some of these displaced persons with certain provisions, provided that they could get letters of assurance, each individually, that some individual in the United States or some community in the United States would guarantee that they would not become dependent upon public welfare, would take responsibility for them, provided they could prove they were not criminals, provided they could pass the physical examinations which were required of them, a difficult thing, for these were those who had been medically decimated by the camp experience, and guaranteeing that in the years ahead, the number who came in under this emergency provision would have their numbers would be deducted from the quotas of Jews to be brought in from other countries in Europe. Under this emergency legislation of 1948, in the next 6 years, about 95,000 Jews were admitted to the United States. Not a great number. It took a long time. President Truman had sent over Mr. Harrison in June of 1945. He'd issued his emergency order in December of 1945. The first were people under this emergency act were allowed into the United States in May of 1946. There were no large numbers until 1948 and 49. 2-3 years passed. And when it was all over in 1951, when the new restrictive McCarran-Walters Immigration Act was passed, less than 95,000 Jews in all, the Sheherit HaPlita, the survivors of this decimation, had been allowed into the United States. Place that against the airlift of Cuban refugees in 1962 through today. Place that against the sea lift of Vietnamese refugees. We moved quickly. We brought in hundreds of thousands, but not in those post-war years. Less than 95,000 were allowed to enter. They came, mostly the young, for only the young survived the war. Anyone who was in his late 30s or older was really too weak, too old to survive the rigors of forced labor and of the camps. They came, and they found that there was a new ordeal to be undergone, the ordeal of being newborn, of being a refugee. You live through 6 years of the worst horror man can imagine. You've lived through 3 or 4 years of limbo in the displaced person camps of Europe. And you come to the United States and you discover that you must sign an oath, literally, that you will go to the place assigned to you and remain there and take the job which is assigned to you. You're a Jew from Warsaw, after all that experience, and you find yourself suddenly in McAlpin, Texas, in the middle of the Weltrhein, in the middle of nowhere, coming in the dark of night. No one there can speak to you. There's some Jews, there's some charity, there's some generosity of spirit, but you're not allowed yet to be given control of your life. You must begin again. And you find that the thing that you need most, being cut off from family, the family has been destroyed, is some kind of friendship, meeting with those who have shared your experience. But because of the organization, the scattering of the Jewish community, because of the letters of assurance, you're sent where you are sent. This is the life from which these new lives begin. It's incredible to think that one can bounce back from this kind of experience with any amount of resiliency, that one can again love and accept love. One can again undertake the responsibilities and obligations of family. And yet it's fascinating to consider how these people reacted. Most of them married, and married quickly. Many of them married while they were still in the displaced persons camps. They married quickly, and they quickly had children. They had to make a commitment to the future. The future was in those children. There was the tightness of family that we have, to a certain degree, forgotten in these latter years. And one would have thought that coming into a strange country, not speaking the language, many of these people would have felt that everything was due them. Yet as you read these interviews, you find that they rather resent the generosity because they don't know how to get out from under. They need, but they don't like to take. The one thing that they have, that they are survivors. They've learned to make out, to be responsible for themselves, however one accomplishes that. They've learned to be on their own, not to be dependent, because dependency was death. And very quickly, most of them struggled and worked to establish themselves here, to free themselves of the agencies, to come into their own and to come out on their own, and to come back to be with their own. Very quickly, they left the small towns and the scattered areas and came together in Forest Hills or Kew Gardens or certain areas of the major cities, living cheek by jowl with those who had shared their experience, who knew how they felt. During the early years, they tried to put it all behind them. They wanted to forget. But then they found that, if these interviews be accurate, that they needed to remember. One of them recalls how when he was in the death camps, where they smelt the stench of death, of mass murder in the air as they worked, one expected death. Death was not the enemy. The one thing he feared was that no one would survive to tell the story. There was an urge to see that the world knew what the world was like, what they had lived through, to know how they had suffered and what had happened to their families. They're not people, if these interviews be accurate, who are moved to vengeance. One woman describes being liberated by the Russians, and the Russians gave her a gun and said, "Here are some Germans, shoot them." And she said, "But I don't know those Germans." There's very little need here for physical vengeance. None of these people who might well have had reason occupied the United Nations in New York and until the United Nations would force the Argentine government to give up all the ex-Nazi Gauleiters who were living in freedom in the Argentine. That's not the way they went. They worked. These were people who testified to the courts, to the tribunals, about war crimes, who were disturbed when the tribunals tended to be narrow in their interpretation of law, protective of those who had war crimes on their hands but who had made a new start in the new Germany or the new Austria. They went and they testified, and they were delighted when finally Israel's long arm reached out and plucked Eichmann out of the Argentine and brought him to the little glass box in Israel, where the world watched as the whole sad, horrible story of the final solution was laid bare. Finally, they felt that the story had been told. And as they came into their own, into America, and began their new lives, they grew to respect this country, its freedoms and its opportunity. You can't understand and truly appreciate America if you're native-born, these interviews say. You take it for granted. And one of the paradoxes of their lives has been that they came into the American freedoms out of this horror, came into appreciate what all that we have at the very time we were losing appreciation for all that we had. They came into it at the very time we were undergoing racism in Vietnam and souring on our country. And when some of their children brought home from school the comments of teachers or school friends who were mouthing all the conventional platitudes which downgraded America. We were America with a capital K. We were a racist, fascist, male chauvinist state, an imperialist state. You remember all of that, late 50s and mostly of the 60s. They shook their heads and they did not understand, because America was security for them and opportunity and freedom. America was not without fault, but there was no country on earth which was as gracious and as open. Suffering, my friends, does not necessarily ennoble. This testimony of these survivors is obviously their understanding of their fate, where they are. I am sure that they have struggled the way all men struggle. They have done things, some of which I'm sure they're not that pleased with, as all of us have done. But their spirit is remarkably resilient. They've come together, they've created fraternities and sororities and groups of survivors. They have reached to understand their past, because to understand their past is to understand themselves. They have gone back to Germany and to Eastern Europe. They wondered American Jews who lived here in security, who refused to deal with Germany or to deal with some of the Soviet states. And at the same time, as they talk about their surprise at the reaction that some of us have, one of the men who was very successful describes how he believes in doing business with the Germans, and most of the Germans were not Nazis, where most of the Germans were young and not responsible for the war. He's gone back to make a number of business deals with the Germans. And surprisingly, none of these deals has ever been consummated. He wants to do it, but he can't bring himself to do it. Clearly, there's a deep fear still in their hearts. Fear that the poisons of anti-Semitism still exist in the German soul, in the European soul, in the world out there. They are less open to the larger world than we are, because they know that their employees and their patients and their students became the Gauleiters and the SS. They know that the woman secretary at the B'nai B'rith headquarters can become overnight the secretary and telephone operator to the man who is holding the hostages, and feel a kinship with him, and be promised security, freedom by him. That woman is the archetypical collaborationist. And these people have known all that anyone will do in order to survive. Suffering has not ennobled them, but suffering has made them perhaps more human, more accepting of life, more grateful for the modicum of pleasures and of the satisfactions, which are the private satisfactions of accomplishment, of family, than we might be. I remember the testimony particularly of one woman. She was elderly, in her 70s, one of the few elderly, for most have died long since. She was born into a wealthy Viennese family, cultured. She and her husband had had an upper middle class life in Amsterdam. They had been members of the bourgeoisie. They had had a fine home. They had given their children a great, expensive education, culture. Everyone had died except herself and her husband, and he had been broken physically by the war, survived the war by a few years. He was now dead. She had raised a daughter, very modest circumstances. They had not been able to find their way back to the standard of living they had once enjoyed. But according to the interviewer, she was a woman of effervescence and of spirit. And I love the way in which she summed up her life. Now I still live on a modest scale. My daughter, it so happened, married a fairly well-to-do man, and she did not want me to work from then on. I don't need much. Sometimes when I crawl into bed at night, I think about the pleasure of the clean sheets and the freedom. I have not taken it for granted yet, but it is all bought with a terrible price. My poor parents, my poor husband. I suppose if it had not been for this tragedy, I would have been living the old life in Europe. I would have been the average middle-aged woman playing bridge in Holland or Vienna with the same circle of friends and gone on vacations mostly to the same place. The Holocaust saved me from this, which is a terrible fate, to grow old among the bourgeoisie of Europe. The spirit which cannot grow old is a spirit which has learnt much. And if any of you are tempted to grow old of spirit, go out and live. Do work. These people know what life is all about. It's about living, sharing, caring. Not about accumulating. Not about status. Not about power, but about love and family and self and the appreciation of the beauties that are available to each of us, the sunlight and art, friendship. Amen.